Up and around the scales they raced, helter-skelter, faster and faster. All but Tubby the tuber. A fat little tuber, puffing away, but oh so slow.
In the children's classic, Tubby the Tuba, a tuba feels sad because all the other instruments in the orchestra get to play the melody, while he gets assigned a boring oompa. But finally, he gets his time to shine. What is the history and repertoire of this giant instrument? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Peter DeVries wrote, "The tuba is certainly the most intestinal of instruments, the very lower bowel of music. Known for its low range and large size, the tuba has played an important role in orchestras, bands, brass ensembles, and jazz. How have different performers changed the notion of what a tuba should sound like? How does a tuba player adjust to different styles of music?" Joining us to survey the world of the tuba is John Stevens, chair of the UW-Madison School of Music, professor of tuba and euphonium, composer, and member of the Wisconsin Brass Quintet.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. Great to be here.
Well, let me put it this way. This might not be the most flattering way to begin, but why was the tuba invented in the first place?
Well, the tuba, like all of us, has ancestors. And the two primary ancestors of our instrument are the serpent and the ophicleide. And the serpent being the older of those two. And the serpent was really originally invented to help beef up the lower voices in choral works, add this sort of low instrumental part that helped make the lower sounds, generally coming from the men, come through and balance a little better with the higher sounds. And then, as has happened over the course of history, various people who were interested in tweaking and inventing and taking musical instruments to a new level, eventually evolved that instrument into something that was a little bit more complex. The ophicleide actually looks like a combination between a large saxophone and a modern-day tuba.
That was still used in Civil War bands, wasn't it?
Yeah, probably so, although by then the valve had been invented for quite a few years, so Civil War instruments tended to more have piston valves rather than keys like a saxophone. They were unusual looking because they were over-the-shoulder instruments usually. And the reason for that, of course, is that they were in the habit of sending the band in front of the troops, and so they wanted to design instruments that could be aimed backwards so the troops could hear them. This wasn't always such a great deal for the band in terms of battle injuries and that sort of thing, but the ophicleide, I think, was really last used regularly in about the middle of the 1800s, the 19th century. Mendelssohn certainly wrote for ophicleide. Berlioz, in some of his works, wrote for the ophicleide. But eventually that evolved into the modern-day tuba. The tuba is the only instrument in the orchestra for which we actually have a specific date and year that can be pointed to from whence it comes. The first patent on a tuba was taken out by two gentlemen in Berlin in 1835. So it's a very young instrument. Compared to all the other instruments of the orchestra, there is no tuba music from the Baroque or classical period, or, you know, no Beethoven for tuba, even the early part of the Romantic period. It's only as we get deeper into the Romantic period that you start seeing the tuba being used more regularly in the symphony orchestra. Although even then, not all the time. For example, of the four Brahms symphonies, only the second uses tuba. 1, 3, and 4 do not. Of course, by the time we got up to Strauss and Mahler and the great late Romantic composers, it was being used much more regularly.
And how do you tell the difference between a tuba and a euphonium and a sousaphone?
That's a great question. The way I would describe a euphonium is that it looks just like a tuba, it's shaped like a tuba, but it's the size of a trombone. So it's if the tuba is a bass or a contrabass instrument, the euphonium is more of a tenor instrument. Brass instruments are divided into two basic families, cylindrical bore instruments and conical bore instruments. The two primary cylindrical bore instruments are trumpet and trombone. And the term cylindrical means that the tubing is essentially the same diameter all the way through the instrument until you get to the bell. The conical instruments are the French horn, euphonium, tuba, and also some members of the trumpet family, flugelhorn and cornet being the ones most commonly used. So if you imagine what those instruments sound like, you can sort of hear that the conical bore instruments have a little bit more of a mellow vocal quality to them, and the cylindrical bore instruments are a little bit more brassy or strident sounding, perhaps. The sousaphone was essentially, I mean, it's everybody thinks it was named after John Philip Sousa, and I suppose it is, except it was really the tuba players in his band, not so much him, that got really tired, their backs especially, got really tired of carrying around upright tubas when they were marching or performing outside. And I don't think they literally did this, but essentially they took a tuba and unwound it into one long tube and wound it back up again into a different shape. Not unlike making pasta, I guess. It's a similar instrument, but it's shaped completely differently so that it would be easier to carry. Now, an interesting element of this is that the early sousaphones were what we call rain catchers. They were worn on the shoulder like the modern-day sousaphone, but the bell pointed up in the air. And there were two very clear problems with this design. Right. The one I've already alluded yes. to.
And the other one is that, sound.
Yeah, the sound just went into the ether and was very difficult to hear. As soon as somebody moved the bell forward, aha. That was one of those aha moments. And the sousaphone, as a result of its design, is very directional. If you're standing right in front of it, it's very loud. And if you move just a little bit off to the side, the sound dissipates rather quickly.
Do sousaphones and tubas use mutes at all?
They do, actually. For a long time in their history, they did not. I mean, the tuba is sort of like the big oafish cousin to the other brass instruments in that it's because it's so young and new and because so many years went by before it was ever conceived of as a possible solo instrument. A lot of the other attributes that the other brass instruments have came later to the tuba. For example, some of the most important early solo music for the instrument didn't really use mutes. It wasn't until we got into the 60s when composers were experimenting a lot anyway with all different styles of, you know, what at that time was avant-garde writing. The tuba became a very attractive instrument to them, actually, because it was a, you know, sort of an open field. I mean, not a lot of music had been written for it. Varèse, for example, wrote a number of things for the tuba, and a lot of composers in the 60s started writing for the tuba, and they started using extended techniques and getting away from writing idiomatically for the instrument, and that included using mutes. Again, I'll go back to the cylindrical versus conical bore issue. We're used to seeing trumpets and trombones, the cylindrical instruments, with straight mutes, cup mutes, harmon mutes, wah-wah mutes, plungers, and they can make a wide variety of sounds. If you think about the French horn, for example, typically horn players have a mute. There's also something called a brass mute, which is used much more seldom, but essentially horn players do almost everything that's muted with one mute. Tuba's the same way. We have what's essentially a straight mute. It's rather large. I mean, if you've ever seen me play in the Wisconsin Brass Quintet, I have to use the mute all the time. I put it on a piano bench next to me because quite often I'm called upon to put it in and take it out fairly quickly in the rests, and I can't be fumbling around with it on the floor and that sort of thing. And the thing about mutes that's important for people to understand is that it not only makes the instrument quieter, but it changes the color of the instrument. And that's another interesting aspect to tubas, actually. If you look at all the brass instruments from, you know, 20 feet away, all trumpets look pretty much the same. Same with French horns and trombones. Sure, there are little differences, triggers on trombone versus no trigger, that sort of thing. Tubas have a much wider variety of design. We have two different types of valves, piston valves that go up and down like trumpet valves, or rotary valves, where you press a spatula and it turns the valve in a rotation, just like French horns. German instruments, European instruments, tend to be made with rotary valves, and American instruments and British instruments tend to be made with piston valves. But as time goes on, those lines are blurring very much. You'll see tubas with large bells, with small bells, with sort of a stovepipe design with a really tall bell, some with really short bells. There's a wide variety of designs, and I attribute this to the fact that the tuba still, you know, isn't even 200 years old yet. It's really still evolving.
One of the 20th century composers that I assume, wrote for the tuba would be Hindemith, since he wrote something for pretty much every instrument.
That's right. That's right. He did. And Hindemith and Vaughan Williams are, I would say, the two sort of well-known classical composers who are the nearest and dearest to the hearts mm-hmm. of tuba players, because Hindemith wrote really the first sonata that kind of took off and was commonly played, and Vaughan Williams wrote the first concerto that was commonly played. Yeah, the Hindemith Sonata has been a staple since the early 50s when it was written, and the tuba has evolved into much more of a solo instrument in the last 50 years, and one of the most important and, for a long time, primary tuba soloists in the world was an American tuba player named Roger Bobo. Roger was the tubist in the LA Philharmonic for years. He had played in the Concertgebouw before then. Eventually, in the 90s, he moved to Europe, lived there for a while. Now he's in his mid-70s and he's living in Japan and he doesn't play anymore. But Roger, in addition to making many record albums, appeared on The Tonight Show and was one of the first tuba players to really bring the tuba into the limelight. And the Hindemith Sonata is one of the pieces that he's recorded. And I thought it might be fun to listen to the first movement of this three-movement work with Roger performing it.
The first movement of Paul Hindemith's Sonata for Tuba, played by Roger Bobo, Hindemith being one of the relatively few composers who actually wrote specifically for the instrument 50 years ago or so. And that means a lot of stolen repertory, doesn't it, John?
Yeah, it does. Even today, the literature that we perform is a mix. I mean, there's tons more original works now, and I've been very pleased to be very involved. I mean, I feel kind of lucky in a way because my life and career have sort of exactly coincided with a huge development of the tuba outside the orchestral and band realms in solo literature and chamber music and that sort of thing, and music of different styles. But no question, if we want to play any Baroque music, if we want to play beautiful melodies, if we want to play Mozart, if, you know, we have to steal, as we put it, or borrow, maybe I should say, music from other instruments, for voice, for lots of different things.
Bassoon? Can you steal from the bassoon?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Certain things lend themselves really well. Actually, I play myself a lot of horn music. I play most of it down an octave, but the tuba sounds so much like the French horn that music that was conceived and written for the French horn tends to work very beautifully on the tuba. For example, one of the pieces that I've been thrilled to perform a few times over my career is the Brahms Horn Trio, which is, you know, whether people think it's a wonderful thing or not a wonderful thing to do on the tuba, I love doing it. And, you know, we're musicians too. Why shouldn't we be able to play Brahms? I brought today sort of a selection of a combination of original works and transcriptions or arrangements to sort of highlight the different kinds of things that the tuba can do. I think it'd be nice to listen to an aria here from by Handel, from The Messiah, played by a tubist named Roland Szentpalli, who's Hungarian. This is a good segue from Roger Bobo, because Roger introduced me to Roland in 1991. Roland was 15 years old at the time. He was this amazing young Hungarian tubist and composer already. I started calling him the Mozart of the tuba because he was really quite a prodigy at both. When I heard this young man play at the age of 15, I thought, holy mackerel, this is the best tuba playing I've ever heard. And he's continued to be a real important force in the tuba world and as a composer. And so I thought it might be nice to listen to Roland play this beautiful aria from The Messiah.
Well, that's the way an aria from Messiah sounds as you substitute tuba for the original voice in the music of Handel. And we'll look further at and hear more from the tuba when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
The bass tuba symbolizes a large, lone creature which keeps itself in check most of the time. It could drown out the orchestra tutti. The mellowness, softness, and roundness of its sound seem to convey more a feeling of security than one of immediate danger. Above all, the tuba symbolizes the voice of a very large beast that is quite simply there and has no need for intimidating gestures because of its huge size. That's from an article about the symbolism of the tuba on the Vienna Symphony Library website. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is John Stevens, and we're exploring the tuba. John, you're also a composer, and you mentioned coming along at a time when the world of tuba composition is really wide open. Can you say something about your own work and what you've been able to do?
Yeah, I've spent most of my career writing. I composed for all kinds of instruments, but a lot for the tuba, my own instrument. And basically, we tuba players, particularly back like when I was in school in the late 60s and early 70s, we had a little bit of a chip on our shoulder because we're sort of seen as kind of second-class musical citizens sometimes, stereotypically. So in an effort to sort of show that we had energy and life and technique and could do anything that any other instruments could do, a lot of composers, including myself, really tried to expand stylistically the kind of literature that's out there. So, and I very much was raised in kind of a jazz environment, so I definitely use that a lot in my own writing. And as I said, I've spent my career really trying to elevate the tuba to a different place musically. I have another side of me too, though, and that is that I love beautiful, lyrical, romantic music. So about 6 years ago, I decided that I was going to record a CD of beautiful tunes, arrangements and transcriptions almost exclusively that I had either performed or I had colleagues saying, oh, you should do this on the tuba, it would be very beautiful. And I put together a CD's worth of music that's either for tuba and piano, tuba alone, or there are four pieces on there that are duets for tuba and euphonium with piano, and my daughter Katie recorded them with me. I thought playing the opening selection from the CD today, which is a very beautiful berceuse by cellist, or written for cello by Frank Bridge, a British composer, might exemplify a slightly different side of the kind of arrangements that we do on the tuba. Thank you.
That's surprisingly beautiful. I didn't think I would say beautiful tuba in the same phrase. But.
Well, it's a very lyrical instrument. I mean, when you think about it, brass playing is exactly the same as singing. The only difference is that when you sing, the part that vibrates is on the inside, your larynx, and when you play a brass instrument, it's on the outside, your lips. But other than that, they're really the same. So we talk about singing a lot in our teaching and our brass playing.
Now, that was actually written for the tuba? No, for the cello.
That was for the cello. Yeah.
I was going to say, because it seems to me, beautiful as that was, that a tuba player in particular, more so than I would think almost any other instrument, would have to be very careful what piece to pick, because there's this danger of tipping over in a comedy, isn't there?
Well, a little bit, I suppose. I mean, the trombone has always been thought of as the comic instrument of the orchestra. I think no matter what you do on the tuba, some people – one of the nice things about our instrument is that more often than not, people are hearing the instrument play something like what we just heard perhaps for the first time. So we're constantly sort of bringing in new fans, as it were. But there are always going to be people that think that anything on the where the tuba is prominent is comical, no matter what you do. So we actually – Tuba players don't really worry about that very much at all, actually, Norman. If there's a piece of music that we decide would be interesting or effective, or we just want to play it, you know, we usually take it. I mean, the next piece that we're going to listen to is a good example of that. I wanted to include something today by Gene Picorni. Gene is the tubist in the Chicago Symphony. Before that, he was in the St. Louis Symphony, spent 1 year in the LA Philharmonic. He played in Israel. He's definitely one of the great orchestral tuba players of all time and certainly the current generation. I developed a much closer relationship with Gene than I had had previously in the late 90s when the Chicago Symphony Orchestra commissioned me to write a concerto for him. And we spent a lot of time together, and he's a wonderful man and a wonderful performer. And his paycheck comes from playing all the great orchestral literature with the Chicago Symphony, but he's definitely a person who likes to push the envelope and try different things on the tuba. So he recorded a number of years ago a short piano prelude by Claude Debussy, arranged for solo tuba and piano. And it's, I gather, a somewhat obscure prelude called General Levine Eccentric. And again, it gives just another sort of style of arrangement or transcription that tuba players seek out in order to have variety in our recitals and performances. Thank you.
What do you think Debussy would think of that?
I think he would like it because it's colorful and adds a different texture and dynamic to the piece. And given the nature of his music and Impressionism in general, I have to believe that would appeal to him.
And that certainly shows off the dynamics, the range of the performer and the instrument.
Yes, yeah. The tuba has a much wider range than most people realize. The very famous American tubist, the late Harvey Phillips, used to talk about the tuba had three registers, the high register, the low register, and the cash register. And what he meant by that was that, a huge amount of our repertoire and the way we earn our living happens within the sort of middle and low register of the instrument. But Berlioz in Symphonie Fantastique wrote up to the B-flat in the middle of the treble clef staff, and we're required to play down off the bottom of the piano in terms of the low register, particularly in some avant-garde solo works. So it's an extremely wide range, not unlike the French horn. Again, the conical bore brass instruments have a wider range than the cylindrical bore.
So it must be hard to do virtuoso performances in a certain way. You're working harder, right, on the tuba?
In a certain way, it's harder to do virtuoso performances. I actually would liken the four brass instruments very much to the four operatic voices, trumpet being equal to soprano, French horn, mezzo, trombone, tenors, and us, the baritones or basses. And when you think about the great opera singers, you know, the ones who are the most famous and who make the big bucks tend to be the sopranos and tenors, the sort of higher voiced instruments. And the tuba is more, you know, I always kind of want to try to sound like Cheryl Mills or somebody, you know,
well,
Thomas Hampson
model.
Or Bryn Terfel, mm-hmm. or that get that kind of breadth and depth and richness, you know, a certain darkness and robust quality to the sound. The nice thing about the tuba is that if we play anything at all that exemplifies technique and speed and facility, it really is arresting to people because they're not expecting it. The next piece that we're going to listen to is a fantastic example of that. With all the great music that Rimsky-Korsakov composed, perhaps it's a little bit unfortunate that he may be most well known for writing Flight of the Bumblebee.
1 minute.
One minute long. But I couldn't come in here today and talk about this instrument without playing something by Pat Sheridan. Pat Sheridan is, by many people's notion, one of the great, if not the greatest tuba player that we've ever had. In a way, I feel kind of bad focusing just on something like Flight of the Bumblebee because he is an absolutely beautiful lyrical singer capable of really moving people on our instrument. But on the other hand, he also has some of the most amazing technical facility that any of us have ever heard by anybody. So I thought it might be fun to take a piece of music that probably everybody has heard, but they haven't necessarily heard it on the tuba, and give them an idea of what Flight of the Bumblebee sounds like in the hands of Pat Sheridan.
Personalize it a little bit at the end there, too.
Yes, yeah, of course.
We'll look more at the tuba when we continue in a moment on University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest John Stevens, who is guiding us through the world of the tuba. There's a lot more to it than you might have thought. And we know, of course, we've talked about this, John, that the tuba has appropriated, let's say, a lot of repertory from other instruments because there, until recent years, was not so much written for the tuba itself. However, in recent years, from what you've implied, there's been quite an explosion of things written just for the tuba.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I think of the amount of repertoire that's available now, say compared to when I was in college in the 60s and 70s, it's astounding. It's just exploded. And this would be solo literature and chamber music, brass quintets. The use of the tuba beyond the symphony orchestra, the wind band, you know, has just grown immeasurably. And I just think it's because tuba players tend to develop good relationships with composers. Composers like the tuba because there isn't a huge body of repertoire for it like there is for other instruments, and it gives them a different direction to go in their composing. And frankly, if a composer writes a piece for tubist, it's going to get played. And so it's a win-win situation for the performers and composers to work together to develop the literature for the instrument.
What sort of music do you find for the tuba coming from other cultures or other places?
Well, again, a wide variety. You know, tubists are starting to get in as the whole music world is sort of becoming more global. You know, it's hard to turn on the radio anymore without hearing influence of, you know, Africa and Asia and music from other continents and other instruments that aren't part of our usual group that we listen to. It's fascinating. A good example is the tune that we're about to hear. Øystein Bodsvik is a Norwegian tubist, a wonderful player. He's really developed something that, although Pat Sheridan, who we just heard, for a few years made his living primarily as a soloist, Øystein is really the first tuba player who, as he does very little teaching, he doesn't play in a symphony orchestra, he is traveling the world making a living as a tuba soloist, something that really never has been done before. And the single piece of music that he's most well known for is something that he wrote himself. It's a piece called Fanug. Fanug is a Norwegian word that applies to something that's so light and fluffy as to be almost inconsequential. He uses the example of a snowflake, would be described as fanug in Norwegian. He wrote this wonderful little piece that he initially used to play sort of as a street musician before he took it to the concert hall stage. It combines extended techniques for the instrument beyond the idiomatic writing that we've heard so far today that calls for kind of singing and playing at the same time and using sounds that you can make with your mouth, but you do it into the tuba and it amplifies it in a certain way. So this is a combination of sort of Australian didgeridoo techniques and applying it to music inspired by Norwegian folk tunes, Fanug.
there's no processing, no overdubbing. There's just one man and one tuba.
One man and one tuba.
It really does sound like didgeridoos.
And, yeah, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, again, the size of the instrument allows us to do... I mean, every instrument has its own what we call extended techniques, you know, things that you can do on the instrument that are not just the standard buzzing of the lips and blowing to create the notes that we're used to hearing. Certain areas of the world, they're much more adventurous in this regard. There's a famous American tubist named Mel Culbertson who lived in France for most of his career. And he has told me that he, in France, has played entire recitals by French composers where he hasn't played one single normal note on the tuba. It's all been, you know, hitting the bell and this technique and that technique to create different sounds.
No, in that case, the piece we just heard, Fanugue, he was singing and playing at the same time.
Singing and playing at the same time, and then also creating the percussive sounds. Very much like somebody like Bobby McFerrin would do with his voice by sort of clicks and pops. But you do it into the tuba mouthpiece, and the instrument amplifies it and allows it to be heard properly. And
in your own compositions, what are some of the things you're the most proud of, I guess, and the things you've written?
Oh, my. Well, I've been very fortunate to have opportunities. I mean, the very first piece I ever was asked to write for symphony orchestra was a concerto for the Chicago Symphony, so I'm certainly very proud of that. I think one kind of interesting thing to talk about is something that hasn't happened yet. It's coming up this November. I'm going over to Germany for a week for three premiere performances of a piece of mine that I was commissioned by a group of German orchestras for their tuba players who form a quartet that's been around for years called the Melton Tuba Quartet. They all play Melton instruments. They're sponsored by that company. They all play in different orchestras, and the orchestra's commissioned what we believe is the first ever original serious work for tuba quartet and orchestra. It's a four-movement piece of about 24 minutes in length, and they've actually recorded it already, along with a lot of my other music for either orchestra or tubas, so that the CD is available and is going to be released at the premiere performances. So that's going to be very exciting. It's got a good Madison connection, actually. The conductor on the recording and the conductor of the premieres will be Carl St. Clair, an American who spends a lot of time in Germany and who has been a fairly regular conductor here with the Madison Symphony and, in fact, is coming back this spring in March to lead them again. I've focused a lot on chamber music, though, in my writing for using the tuba in the brass quintet. And I would say I'm probably regarded as one of the primary people in the world to write for the tuba and euphonium in ensemble, in quartets and larger ensemble pieces. I've been doing it since I was in graduate school. In fact, a piece, the very first piece that I ever wrote, which is a little short work called Power, kind of a rock fanfare, is still performed all over the world by groups from high school up to professional level. In fact, the Melton Quartet re-recorded Power on this new CD that's coming out. I'm really proud of the fact that one of the leading quartets in the world got their start here when they were all students of mine at the university. They're called the Sotto Voce Quartet, which is a wonderful name, but it does not describe their personalities or their music making. They are a really exciting group of guys, and they've been going now for well over 10 years. They have two or three recordings out. And a number of years ago, they did me a great honor and came to me and said, we'd like to do a CD recording of all your quartets. And that was wonderful. I was so excited about it. We actually did one quintet where I joined them and performed on it. But I said, okay, if you guys are going to do that, I'm going to write a new piece for you for this new recording. And what that gradually morphed into was two pieces. So I thought what we might do today is listen to a couple of very different examples of the way a tuba euphonium quartet can sound. Essentially, this is the tuba equivalent of a string quartet. Two euphoniums on the top voices, two tubas on the bottom voices. The first piece is called Viva Voce. It's a short work, very much in a contemporary sort of jazz style. It's meant to be really exciting and vivacious. And then I wrote a piece called Benediction, which was, as you might expect, intended to close the CD and sort of focus more on the beautiful lyrical sonorous quality of the instruments. Thank you. Okay, and now we'll close with the benediction.
Thank you.
Benediction, the work of John Stevens, who has been our guest for this hour of University of the Air, guiding us through the capabilities and the repertory of the tuba.
It's been a great pleasure to be here. I hope everyone's enjoyed this little venture into our big low instrument.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.